I apologize for skipping the two chapters on children, the training of them. I felt it was limiting our audience. There are not too many who are here usually are training small children. There are some. If you'd like to study, I'd be glad to do it with you in a smaller group. I thought it would have more appeal if we studied a chapter that had a broader perspective for ages. And so we're skipping two chapters, and we are in the chapter now, True Education, a Missionary Training. And again, I wish to remind you that this chapter is in a book on healing. For true education in its right interpretation is healing, not only of the mind, but also the physical and spiritual aspects of man as well. For true education covers the whole person, as we'll study tonight. And she defines true education as a missionary training. Any education that does not train for missionary work is not true education. It might be education, but it's not true. It's another kind. And so she's limiting what she means by that. Now, I'd like to begin on page 396 and read a small quotation there about three-fourths of the way down the page. All scripture except for two or three words. God so loved that he gave. And she leaves out the rest of the verse in John 3:16, gave his only begotten son that we should not perish but have everlasting life. And so the emphasis is on the giving. Christ hath loved us and hath given himself for us. If we love, we shall give. Not to be ministered unto, but to minister, is the great lesson which we are to learn and to teach. Now, the words of the Bible and the spirit of prophecy are usually simple because they wish to appeal to all people. And the emphasis here is on giving and ministering, for ministering is a form of giving, if it's ministering and not administering, as many like to make it. And these quotations are emphasizing that missionary service is giving. True education is training for missionary work. Or true education is training for giving. You say, we ought to know how to give. That's not too difficult. But we need to learn how to give in missionary endeavor. And giving accomplishes that. Now, please do not omit the concept that we're talking here now about the idea of healing. For giving has in it healing. You might not believe that, but I want to show you that it does. I want to refer back to some quotations I've used here many, many times in different services, because the thoughts are so complex that we never quite understand all that they say. And I refer to Desire of Ages, page 20 and 21. You've heard them many times. It'll be seen that the glory shining in the face of Jesus is the glory of self-sacrificing love. In the light from Calvary, it'll be seen that the law of self-renouncing love is the law of life for earth and heaven. Healing is restoring life, right? Giving back life. That's healing. The opposite of death. So now the law of life, earth, and heaven is the law of self-renouncing love. Then she goes on to explain that everything in nature lives to give. The birds, the flowers, the ocean, the sunshine, the clouds, on you can go. Animals, they all live to give. Then she turns on top of page 21 to the angels. Are they not all ministering spirits? She tells us. They give too. And then she says, but turning from all lesser representations, we behold God in Jesus. In other words, we see God in the angels, we see God in nature. But the best is in Jesus. We see him there. Looking unto Jesus, we see that it's the glory of our God to give. Now, God is the source of all life. The one who is the life giver, the source of all life, it's his glory to give. So the fountain of life, the one who is life himself or who inspires and causes life, it's his glory to give. So giving is associated intimately with living, right? And I mean everlasting living, undying living, immortality. I'm talking about everlasting life. Then she says, in these words is set forth a great principle, which is the law of life for the universe. And she closed the paragraph by saying, that thus through Christ the circuit of beneficence is complete, representing the character of the great, capital G, giver, the law of life. And then she contrasts that in two sentences following it. In heaven itself this law was broken. Sin originated in self-seeking. And of course sin brings what? Death. So now selfishness fosters death automatically. Giving fosters life automatically. It's illustrated in many, many ways, the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. One always gives and it has living waters. The other one always receives and never gives and it has dead waters, right? A brackish pond that never gives, everything in it eventually dies, you see. Vegetation, the animal life, the fish, and so forth. A person who's always receiving, never giving, is dying a very hasty death. One who's always giving seems to live on and on and on. Work is one of the principles of giving. If you work, exercise, as you expend yourself, you live more, right? You live longer, generally speaking. This is a law of life. So the giving of health or life is giving, you see. Missionary service is giving, and that is living, and that produces life in the recipients. Are you still with me? It's life both to the giver and life to the receiver. So true education fosters this giving, which produces life for the receiver and the giver. And this is a very basic, elementary aspect of Christian living. Now, too much education that we have nowadays is strictly receiving. In fact, we think we're going to be better able to help others if we receive more. Unfortunately, receiving more of what makes us want to receive more, right? And we become addicts to education. Is that possible? We become addicts to education. There are many educational addicts, and they're just as addicted as those on drugs, if not worse. In fact, they're still addicted when they're late in life. Now, I'm not against education, nor is God. But when it fosters nothing but self-seeking, you see, then we're on the wrong road, right? We're on a trip, as the young people call it nowadays, and it's all ego. It's not to bless someone else. And so this is not true education, then. It just enhances self. So don't forget that missionary service is a life of giving. And that's a life of living and a life of healing. When trained for that, we're actually training people to heal others. And you discover this is true because as you love other people and serve them, they love you in return. They have a better disposition. Then you have a better one. They have a better one, right? Becomes a very, very great cycle of blessing. Then they bless others because they have a nice disposition. They go home and they're sweet to their wife. The wife is sweet to the children, right? And a merry heart doeth good like a medicine. And it covers many, many people. And it has a very positive emphasis in everyday living, which we often miss as a very simple rule. So this is a law of life, this law of giving, this law of loving others, self-renouncing, self-sacrificing love. And this is where the healing aspect comes in. Now back to the beginning of that chapter. True education is missionary training. Every son and daughter of God is called to be a missionary. We are called to the service of God and our fellow men. And to fit us for this service should be the object of our education. Now, if you're spending your money for something else, you're wasting it. Because it'll be very, very temporary. It's almost as bad as spending your money for liquor. Because it's so temporary, the effect is quickly gone. And you'll need some more. And that won't satisfy either, and so you'll need some more. And you see, the thing we're hearing nowadays from many, many educated people is that my training has fitted me to do some work, but it's not fulfilling, it's not rewarding. And hundreds of people are saying now, young and old alike, can't I do something that's more rewarding, more fulfilling? Yes, you can. You might have to be trained for it, and you say, but I have a degree, I know. But a degree for what? A degree for serving others or for serving self? And it makes a difference, doesn't it? When we have the degree for serving others, forgetful of self, then we're rewarded. But if a serving self, unmindful of others, then we're not rewarded. What we get in our hands and put in the bank or whatever it is not very rewarding. And after this materialism has lasted now for, 30-some years, we're saying now, you know, I don't like it. It isn't really blessing me inwardly. I have a lot of nice things, but I wish I had something else. And I've heard very many wealthy people say, very wealthy people, you know, what I have is not rewarding. I just am not achieving. And they're very depressed over it. They keep looking around for something else to do that's more fulfilling. And several professional people have said to me in recent months, I don't care how little I earn if I can only serve somebody and be a blessing to them. It doesn't matter to me. And those are delightful words to God, let me assure you. If we just will forget ourselves to go out and be a blessing to someone else, God will smile upon us. You can count on that. And we'll live a very fulfilling, rewarding life, and we'll go to bed at night very happy, although often extremely exhausted. And so This is what the Lord would have us to do. Missionary training for missionary service, which is giving, and that enables us to truly live for God. Now, there's much said about all of this, and I don't have time to cover it all. She talks about worthy goals. And we read part of this sometimes and miss the other part, and we don't understand what she means by that. Page 396, the middle of the page. God's word does not repress activity. She's talked about young people being very active, either for good or evil. He doesn't repress activity, but he guides it aright. God does not bid the youth to be less aspiring. And we read that and stop. So I have great aspirations. The Lord told me to go ahead. You know, shoot the moon. But she changes it. She goes along. She modifies it. The elements of character that make a man truly successful and honored among men, the irrepressible desire for some greater good, the indomitable will, the strenuous application, the untiring perseverance, are not to be discouraged. And still more qualifications now. She doesn't want to discourage this, you see, this elements of character that make a person push forward, the truly successful and honored man. Irrepressible desire for some greater good, indomitable will, strenuous application, untiring perseverance. These are not to be discouraged. By the grace of God, they are to be directed to the attainment of objects as much higher than mere selfish and worldly interests, as the heavens are higher than the earth. Go way beyond those selfish ideas. You can aspire, but not to selfish attainments. Right? Leave self out of the picture. And you can have that strenuous application, that untiring perseverance and indomitable will, but not for self. Not to enhance self, but to bless others. As goals and objects is much higher than the mere selfish and worldly interests, as the heavens are higher than the earth. So forget the selfish. People read part of this and they say, God approves of my selfish aspirations. No, he doesn't either. In fact, you better go back and learn how to read. Or he'll never approve, you see. We need to go on in this. But there are certain things he does approve of, at which we can expend great energy and great perseverance. And he rewards us for it and loves that. And he wants it. We must not suppress those things. But they must be directed into proper channels and with proper goals. Or otherwise we'll find ourselves trapped. Now, the views of this higher goal are described on page 397. And she puts it in such lofty terms that you might even miss it. It's so hard to understand what she's saying in some ways, but it's very simple language. Next to the angelic beings, the human family, formed in the image of God, are the noblest of his created works. So we're very high, lofty creatures. God desires them to become all that he has made it possible for them to be, and to do their very best with the powers he has given them. Now, if you stop there, you might understand, but the next sentence or two are filled with mysterious qualities. Life is mysterious and sacred. It, meaning life, is the manifestation of God himself, the source of all life. Now up there, as we're created just below the angels, you see, noble creatures, we have that life that is to be a reflection of the likeness of God, you see. We have that life. Life is mysterious and sacred. It is the manifestation of God himself, the source of all life. As God reveals himself in nature, and the sun and the stars and the flowers and the birds and the animals and the plants, in the colors and the sounds. His love is revealed there. So God is revealed in us, he desires to be. And as you're trained for missionary service, you're trained to reveal God, correct? That's our aspiration. That's our goal. That's our work. Now, can you think of anything greater than revealing God? It isn't just the preacher that's to reveal God in his thoughts, ideas, doctrines. That isn't it at all. His teachings. The physician is to reveal God in healing of the body, right? Right? The mother is to reveal God in her work. The father in his work. The carpenter in his work. Isn't that right? The farmer in his work. The housewife in her work. No matter where we are, the nurse in her work. All of them. Anything you can discuss, we're to reveal God. And that particular work is suited for it. There we are to serve God and reveal him. So life is a manifestation of God himself, the source of all life. He's being manifested in us. Precious are its opportunities in life, you see, and earnestly should they be improved. Once lost, they're gone forever, those opportunities. They just slip away. So he wants us to reveal God. Then she describes it in little down-earth terms. Before us, God places eternity with its solemn realities and gives us a grasp on immortal, imperishable themes. He presents valuable, ennobling truth that we may advance in a safe and sure path in pursuit of an object worthy of the earnest engagement of all our capabilities. So he wants us to do something more worthwhile than merely seeking selfish goals. Lift up your eyes and shoot higher and aim higher, because to reveal God is the noblest of all goals. And he wants to bless us in doing that. He wants us to enable us to do that. And then we can do marvelous things for him. She comes down to the bottom, page 397, the last paragraph. God looks into the tiny seed that he himself has formed and sees wrapped within it the beautiful flower, the shrub, or the lofty, wide-spreading tree. So does he see the possibilities in every human being. We are here for a purpose. God has given us his plan for our life. What is that? To reveal him. God has given us his plan for our life, and he desires us to reach the highest standard of development. Now, many of us read these things become extremely frustrated. And we say, I'm trying, but I don't see too much revelation. That's the wrong idea, isn't it? Perhaps we ought to go back and learn how to submit, how to sit at the feet of Jesus, as did Mary, until we begin to appreciate his character, his love, his grace, his long-suffering, and all the rest of the things we could say about him. And as we begin to appreciate those things, we begin to realize that these ought to be revealed, that these things are what the world needs. What the world needs is Jesus, just a glimpse of him. Even a little glimpse would be a tremendous revelation to the world. And our task is to reveal him, no matter what our profession or occupation. That's what we're here for. And that giving will make us live and make the recipients live as well. Not only this life, but the life to come. Both lives are covered, as we'll come to in just a minute in one of our quotations. And so we have this plan for our life, and we're to use it. Page 398, about one-fourth of the way down and one-third. It should be their ambition to excel in all things that are unselfish, high, and noble. Their ambition. The Lord approves ambition, providing it's rightly directed. All things that are unselfish, high, and noble is what he honors. The next thing he talks about is the real meaning of missionary service and what it's all about. And this we have understood but vaguely, even the ministers who profess to be doing this, and the Bible workers as well. In the middle of page 398. The highest of all sciences is the science of soul saving. If you don't believe it, show us how to do it. We'll watch you. For a couple years or five, show us how. Take us to one of the experts, will you? I've been looking for one for a long time, as long as I've been a Seventh-day Adventist. Show me an expert soul winner. Any place. I have yet to find one. I've never seen one. I really haven't. I've seen people trying with varying success, but I've never seen an expert soul winner. Have you? I've never seen one. You look back in the Bible in Pentecost, you begin to see some soul winners, but I've seen none like that. In order to duplicate them, we get a whole large number of ministers, and we haven't preached for a whole year, and we accumulate all our baptisms, baptize one time, and say we duplicate a Pentecost. And I think that's a wee bit of ignorance on our part. That's not Pentecost at all. At Pentecost, they did some unusual things. The highest of all science is the science of soul winning. The greatest work to which human beings can aspire is the work of winning men from sin to holiness. For the accomplishment of this work, a broad foundation must be laid. A comprehensive education is needed, an education that will demand from parents and teachers such thought and effort as mere instruction in the sciences does not require. In other words, it requires a far greater education, a different type than any other science, no matter what it is. Something more is called for than the culture of the intellect. Notice that? It isn't just tickling the brain and giving something there. Education is not complete unless the body, the mind, and the heart are equally educated. The character must receive proper discipline for its fullest and highest development. All the faculties of mind and body are to be developed and rightly trained. It is a duty to cultivate and exercise every power that will render us more efficient workers for God. And we tell our children, please don't get involved in soul winning. You know, it's so degrading. You don't get much money. The church members criticize you. You get between factions. It's a thankless task. Please do anything but become a minister or a Bible worker. You know? Why don't you do something that makes some money, that has a little honor and prestige, but don't become a minister? Our teachers say that. Don't tell me they don't. They told me.
Our parents say that. Our churches act that way. Our conferences act that way. And even our general conference. For the general conference tells you you're not doing very much unless you climb the ladder to become a conference president. So to be a soul winner and not an administrator is a thankless, low, degrading job. And we're advertising to every young person that's born. And we've been doing it for many, many years. Don't stay down in the gutter of work when you can be an administrator. To minister is not a proper work. God doesn't bless you there unless you climb out of it into a higher realm of activity. Now, don't tell me we don't say that. I have to fight with them all the time. Incessantly. We somehow think that if you're an administrator, you're doing a more noble work than ministering. An administrator is not ministering in our denomination, usually. It is not. It's bossing. And that's not ministering. Ministering is servitude. Right? There's no science as high as the science of soul winning. And the education for it is required as much higher. There's no nuclear physicist that should have the education of a soul winner. Because it's a lower science. Much lower. It's not transforming minds. It's just working with materials. Things, but not humans. Only as they try to destroy them or give them some electricity. And this is a vastly different thing. And we have done a jeopardy to God's program of ministry for many, many decades. And the result is we're suffering, and we deserve to suffer. In a recent graduating class in one of our colleges, where they had a large number of ministerial students, there wasn't one of them that had more than a C average in the entire college graduating class. I know because I read it myself. There was no one that graduated with any honors of any kind, not even recommendations. Do you know why? Because if they could get a B average, it wouldn't be there. And all the other students are telling them that. They take it as a last resort. And our students know that. Our students have said, you know, if you can get A's, you'll go to medicine. If you can't, you better go in the ministry. And this has happened for many years. When I was in college, the professors, many of them, talked to the students that got good grades and said, why are you in a ministerial student? What are you doing there? You have better brains than that, you know. Use them for something worthwhile. And bore our people stiff on Sabbath morning. Isn't that right? That's what they're saying. Then they complain because the fellow who graduates can't give them something worthwhile on Sabbath morning when they've taken away all the students that could possibly do it. I'm telling you the truth. This is a testimony, not a criticism. And you think this way, most of you. Just what have you told your children about their future? What direction do you give them as children? What have you recommended for them? What have you planned for them? What do you tell them about their future in life? What are your aspirations for them? It isn't soul winning. In most cases. In fact, it's a rare exception. Somehow, you know, we've missed the truth that the highest of all science is the science of soul winning. We've missed that. And there's nothing as rewarding as soul winning. Because the results of it are for eternity. The results of everything else come to an end eventually, and often very soon. And it's a shame, you know, that we cannot see beyond the end of our noses when it comes to what we're producing in life. That throughout eternity, they'll thank the soul winners. But in other professions, just in this life, and I don't mean to say other professions can't be soul winning. All professions should be soul winning, should they not? But we've distorted them too, haven't we? We've made medicine a production line, and many doctors lament. They're the worst critics of this I know of. They lament, you know, that all they do is just push people on out the door. They don't want to do it. But often it's a necessity by the very demands of the people themselves. Many teachers lament that their classes are so large that they don't even know the IBM card number of the student that's there, much less his name or her name. And the students lament that they are not even known. They have no discussions, just lectures. And the teachers don't want to be called to things like that. In all professions, it seems like we're just taking away the thrill of soul winning and individual effort on the one-to-one basis. We just don't have time to treat people as people, and especially like Jesus treated them. Somehow we must go back and rescue this. And I hear hundreds of people nowadays saying, I want a life that's rewarding like soul winning. How do I get that? And unfortunately, we've not trained our pastors to be soul winners, so we can't tell you how. We're trained to be administrators. because that's the way you get promoted. So if we handle the money wisely and organize the church well, we're good at organized administrators, we'll become conference presidents. And we'll leave the pastoring to those that don't know how to administer and probably don't know how to soul win either. And this is honest. This is happening over and over again. In order to stay in soul winning, you have to fight nowadays against all the other pressures that will call you away from it, because people are clamoring for this help and will do everything else but it, but that, because other things seem more prestigious to us. Even our denomination rewards administrators more than soul winners, right? And we make soul winning nothing but goals, like we do for ingathering too often. Goals to be attained rather than souls to be loved and won for the kingdom. And how the devil's come down to destroy this greatest of all sciences, one of the most fulfilling, most rewarding. Now she talks about the education for this. True education includes the whole being. Your life must witness, not just your words. Isn't that right? You must have a winning life, a winning character, a winning disposition, a winning personality that only Christ can produce. So education must accomplish that. God working through a godly teacher to accomplish this. It teaches the right use of oneself. It enables us to make the best use of brain, bone, and muscle, of body, mind, and heart. The faculties of the mind, as the higher powers, are to rule the kingdom of the body. The natural appetites and passions are to be brought under control of the conscience and the spiritual affections. Then we become a whole, complete witness, do we not, for God? Mental, physical, and spiritual. And the people see this right away. The life is a testimony. And then there's an influence, a godly influence for good emanating from that person. Now she talks about Jesus and his education and his influence long before he goes out in his ministry. And it's so revealing if you just stop to think about it, page 399 and 400. Jesus secured his education in the home. His mother was his first human teacher. From her lips and from the scrolls of the prophets, he learned of heavenly things. He lived in a peasant's home. Notice the language? A peasant's home. And faithfully and cheerfully acted his part in bearing the household burdens. Education now. Bearing the burdens. He who had been the commander of heaven was a willing servant, a loving, obedient son. He learned a trade. With his own hands, worked in the carpenter shop with Joseph. In the garb of a common laborer, he walked the streets of the little town, going to and returning from his humble work. And it shows a picture in the old ministry of healing going down the street. With the people of that age, the value of things was estimated by outward show. As religion had declined in power, it had increased in pomp. The educators of the time sought to command respect by display and ostentation. I wonder what their graduation services looked like. To all this, the life of Jesus presented a marked contrast. His life demonstrated the worthlessness of those things that men regarded as life's great essentials. What a contradiction. His life demonstrated the worthlessness of those things that men regard as life's great essentials. Things you and I exalt to the highest heaven, his life demonstrates the worthlessness of those things. She goes on and amplifies it. The schools of his time, with their magnifying of things small and their belittling of things great, he did not seek. His education was gained from heaven, appointed sources. And what are those? From useful work, from the study of the scriptures, from nature, from the experiences of life. Now she calls that education from heaven. I'll repeat them, you see. Gained from heaven-appointed sources, useful work, study of the scriptures, nature, experiences of life. God's lesson books, right, plural? God's lesson books, full of instruction to all who bring to them the willing hand, the seeing eye, and the understanding heart. My, I wish I understood all that saying, don't you? Who goes to school anymore, you know, at the school of useful work? Some are longing to, would like to. But who goes to school to learn at the school of useful work? Study the scriptures? Some, yes. From nature? Some. Experience of life. Today we've decided that those who live the longest are the dumbest. And forgive me for the expression. In other words, you learn nothing by life's experience. One man wrote in the San Francisco Chronicle about 6 or 7 years ago that everybody over 40 ought to be killed. And I thought to myself, he's destined to become more and more stupid as he goes along, because eventually he'll arrive at 40 and be dumb as the rest of us. Isn't that right? Really, it's amazing how we think that we're bright until we get a little older, and then we're ignorant, you see. And it used to be that we thought that as you would grow older, you'd get wiser. And somehow in our idea of progress and youth and energy and vigor and all these things, we relegated the wisdom gained from life's experiences to the dump of education. You know, there's just nothing there to be had. In school, yes. In higher schools, yes. But never in age. Never in life's experiences. But she says this is one of God, heaven's appointed agencies to educate us. Life's experiences. And the wisest can learn from the experience of others. And that's the only reason for books, right? Books merely tell you the experience of others. It doesn't matter what field. You're just learning in a book what someone else has learned by hard experience, aren't you? Hopefully we'll learn by that and believe it. But now even that we don't understand anymore. So we learn by life's experiences. And this makes us wiser and wiser. If we only learn to sit at the feet of some aged people and ask them some questions about life and see what they would say. It used to be in bygone years, you know, that a young person would consult with an older person, a much older person, and say, what do you think I'll do in these circumstances? And they would always go to the aged for advice. In fact, Ellen White has taught us in our churches, we ought to have older men in the churches for advice, and we ought to have young men out in the firing line, winning souls and evangelism. That's her concept of pastoring and ministry and soul winning. Because the old men have learned something by then, and they can rightly advise us. Nowadays, the young want to be counselors, and they want to push the old off the seat, you know, in retirement someplace. We're not old enough to be counselors, many of us. Isn't that right? We're just not old enough yet. And we don't recognize how much we lacked that until we get older. Then we say, how foolish I was when I was counseling when I was young. You know, I had to keep my mouth shut then. And you feel like saying nothing when you get older because you don't respect your own wisdom. But that's when we begin to learn something. These are God's books of education. It tells how Christ grew, waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom. The grace of God was upon him. Thus prepared, he went forth to his mission. In every moment of his contact with men, exerting upon them an influence to bless, a power to transform, such as the world had never witnessed. How little respect we have for the simple educational means that the God of heaven used to educate the Messiah. Right? And his disciples, the apostles, the highest office in the church, the prophets, the priests, were trained often like this. Just like this. And we have turned to copy something entirely different, as though the world could do a better job than we are doing. And we're doing what they recommend and not what God recommends, and someday they'll come back to tell us about it. She goes on at page 401 and says, very early, the lessons of helpfulness should be taught the child. Now she's talking about what we need to learn, especially in the home. Lesson of helpfulness. As soon as strength and reasoning power are sufficiently developed, he should be given duties to perform in the home. Helpfulness, duties. Notice that? Simple things. He should be encouraged in trying to help father and mother. Helpfulness. Encouraged to deny and to control himself. To put others' happiness and convenience before his own. To watch for opportunities to cheer and assist his brothers and sisters and playmates, to show kindness to the aged, the sick and the unfortunate. Forgetting self, ministering to others, you see, over and over again. Simple little lessons. The more fully the spirit of true ministry pervades the home, the more fully it will be developed in the lives of the children. They will learn to find joy in service and sacrifice for the good of others. So the smallest child, learning to help others and forget self. Just those simple lessons. Now she goes on to the next step, the school itself, which is to cooperate with the mother and father in the home in producing some of these things. Begins in the home, the school is a supplement, page 401. The home training should be supplemented by the work of the school. The development of the whole being, physical, mental, and spiritual, and the teaching of service and sacrifice should be kept constantly in view. Not only the physical, mental, and spiritual, but the teaching of service and sacrifice always kept in view. Now, this is something we do not learn quickly. Isn't that correct? Service and sacrifice come very slowly. above any other agency, service for Christ's sake in the little things of everyday experience has power to mold the character and to direct the life into lines of unselfish ministry. Above any other agency, you see, service for Christ, even the smallest details. To awaken this spirit, to encourage and rightly to direct it, is the parents' and teachers' work. No more important work could be committed to them. Awaken that service for Christ, you see, service and sacrifice. No more important work. The spirit of ministry is the spirit of heaven. And with every effort to develop and encourage it, angels will cooperate. This is healing. This is healing. Giving is living. It's healing. It's blessing. It's transforming. It's uplifting. It's inspiring. It's molding character that's like that of God. So service is the true education. The truly educated person is educated for service. He's rightly trained. Then he goes out to be a blessing to mankind in all of his work. Such an education must be based upon the Word of God. Here only are its principles given in their fullness. You will not find service any other place like you find in the Bible. You will not find the spirit of self-denial or sacrifice any other place. It's there. The Bible should be made the foundation of study and of teaching. The essential knowledge is a knowledge of God and of Him whom He has sent. Now, I wish we'd get some discussion groups and sit down and look at this for a long, long time. We are missing the boat thousands of miles and think we're very close to the goal. And we just don't understand. We read things, we put them in the context of our former experience or education in non-Adventist schools. And we say, see, it's just about like that. No, put the right twist to it. It isn't like that. It's the complete opposite. All worldly education is only for self. Get rich. Make all you can. Gain prestige. Do this, do that. Enhance yourself. Be somebody. Be something. Sacrifice is missing. It doesn't talk about blessing mankind. Most worldly education is like that. Almost any place you go nowadays, it's been like that for generations. It's the opposite to talk about ministry and self-forgetfulness. Don't worry about how much money you'll get. Don't worry about making a living. Don't worry about those things. Be concerned about one thing, serving mankind. One thing. It's very difficult to find that taught any place, inside or outside the church. Very difficult. And we're coming to a paragraph on that that we surely have missed. Now, the next section on the top of page 402 tells some things about education in our schools that are to be emphasized. Four branches of study, so far as I can see. Every child, every youth should have a knowledge of himself, his physical habitation. That means physiology. Ought to know his body. That ought to be taught, if I understand that the sentence there. The second one is found all should be thoroughly grounded in the common branches of education. Reading, writing, arithmetic, if you want to call it that. I'm sure it includes more than that. That's the second area. That's primary area nowadays. Thirdly, they should have industrial training. That'll make men and women of practical ability fitted for the duties of everyday life. That's why we're trying to get a manual arts building. And the fourth one, to this should be added training and practical experience in various lines of missionary effort. Do you realize, if you wanted to be a Bible worker today, that you couldn't find a place to take the course until 1 year ago? And only one Adventist college in all of North America has any course for a Bible worker today. That's Atlantic Union College, just experimenting with it starting a year ago, this summer. I think this month. All other colleges have abandoned the course many, many years ago. It doesn't exist for man or woman. A course on how to give Bible studies is almost non-existent. It's not even required for ministerial training in some areas. It's amazing that this is what's happened. In other words, soul winning is even neglected now from the ministry and omitted. And it's no longer a necessity. Other things are required, but that isn't. And so this idea of missionary effort is missing. We've come back and made it extracurricular by the students going over to foreign fields for a year of service, but that's just a few select people. Bring them back for a couple programs and forget about it, you see. That's not the emphasis, really. We're not being educated and trained for it, except as we go to seek it by ourselves. The next section is a most amazing one. We learn by imparting. And here we're having great difficulty, especially with the large schools we have nowadays. It's almost impossible to implement some of these things because the logistics become great. The larger the school and the larger the classes. Let the youth advance as fast and as far as they can in the acquisition of knowledge. That's good. We're trying to do that in many schools nowadays. Let their field of study be as broad as their powers can compass. But only as they're able to, you see, not as they aspire to, but as they can compass. And as they learn, let them impart their knowledge. Just don't keep it for themselves. And they don't wait 4 or 5 years or 16 years to do that. They begin immediately, probably the day they receive, I think is the idea here. It is thus that their minds will acquire discipline and power. It is the use they make of knowledge that determines the value of their education. To spend a long time in study with no effort to impart what is gained often proves a hindrance rather than a help to real development. In both the home and the school, it should be the student's effort to learn how to study and how to impart the knowledge gained. Whatever his calling, he is to be both a learner and a teacher as long as life shall last. Thus he may advance continually, making God his trust, cling to him who is infinite in wisdom, who can reveal the secrets hidden for ages, and so on. I believe with all my heart in the one teacher, eighth grade school. In spite of all the educators in the world, my head is that hard. I believe the others are far, far behind the one teacher, eighth grade school. Miles and miles and miles behind. Because every older student must teach a younger one in those schools. The teacher cannot teach them all. It's impossible. That's the nicest thing that ever happened to a student. The teacher cannot teach everybody arithmetic. So the eighth grader teaches the seventh graders or the sixth graders. And the sixth grader teaches the fourth graders. And the fourth grader teaches the first graders. That is tremendous. That is just of tremendous worth. Then suddenly they're doing something with what they have learned. And that's a great benefit. As soon as that begins to happen, then they begin to learn better and better and better. I do not think we'll ever improve upon that system. No matter how long we do research, no matter how much we get visual aids and all the kinds of aids, I don't think we'll ever improve upon those who are using their knowledge to bless other students in the classroom. It's a blessing when the teacher can't accomplish it all, not a curse. Isn't it? The student might not be the best teacher in the world, but the student is using what he's learned or what she's learned. I know in college mathematics classes, some students had to teach other students because the teacher didn't know how to teach. I mean freshman algebra. And then for two students that had it in high school, nearly all the class would have flunked because the teacher had a PhD in math, but he couldn't teach. And so in 5 minutes before class and 5 minutes after class, the two students that already had it would teach other students the math that the teacher couldn't teach. It was a great blessing to those imparting, and the others were learning as well. Now, I learned when I was back in flying school that you never learn as well as when you begin to teach others and use what you have. I went to a standardization school for instructors where I was going to learn how to teach other students. I was given a teacher whom I didn't like his appearance, but I found out, as I've told you before, that he was the sharpest flyer I'd ever seen in my life. You cannot judge by appearances. And he was a very exacting teacher. So exacting that when we completed the course, he did not pass us. He put us on probation for a month. All his students. There are many students with other teachers, but they all passed with flying colors. We were held back. So I went out to teach my own students for a month and then came back for a check ride with this teacher. And he told me exactly what to do on the ground, went up for an hour and came back, and he said, "You learn fast." And I was a month late. But what I couldn't learn by practice, I learned by teaching. I had practiced and practiced things he taught me, and I still couldn't do them the way he wanted them. But I hadn't been teaching 2 weeks when I knew how to do everything he taught me. I don't understand that completely. Not everything about it. I wish I did. But I suppose when you have to teach somebody else, you have to analyze everything about it. And you're really teaching yourself, aren't you? Before that, you don't analyze so carefully. But every student is different, make all kinds of mistakes. You have to tell him what he's doing wrong in every maneuver. And so your mind becomes more analytical and more observing. You begin to find out what you're doing wrong, too. And you have to do it right for him or he'll never learn what's right. And I had a concept of the right, but I couldn't do it. But it wasn't very long until I could by teaching. By imparting, we learn. It's true in every profession, in every skill, is it not? It's very, very true. So when you get out and begin to use it, suddenly you're adept at doing it. And you can't understand why. So it isn't always practice that makes perfect. Sometimes it's teaching that makes perfect, isn't it? Because they're using it in a little different way. And this is a marvelous thing that's given here about education that we need to learn. I must race on. The time is running away from me. The influence of association is dealt there on page 403. And I wish we had more time to talk about this. God has asked His people to be separate. And we don't like that sometimes. We misunderstand it. But I wish you'd read that whole section of this chapter to understand. She says there on the top of page 403, it's a terrible fact, and one that should make the hearts of parents tremble, that in so many schools and colleges to which the youth are sent for mental culture and discipline, influences prevail which misshape the character, divert the mind from life's true aims, and debase the morals. Through contact with the irreligious, the pleasure-loving, and the corrupt, many, many youth lose the simplicity and purity, the faith in God, and the spirit of self-sacrifice that Christian fathers and mothers have cherished and guarded by careful instruction and earnest prayer is gone. You see, they lose that. Friends, she's not only talking about non-Adventist schools. There are thousands of people walking as a testimony that this has happened in our schools. This very paragraph. The next paragraph has happened to more than those thousands. Many who enter school with the purpose of fitting themselves for some line of unselfish ministry become absorbed in secular studies. An ambition is aroused to win distinction in scholarship, to gain position and honor in the world. The purpose for which they entered school is lost sight of, and the life is given up to selfish and worldly pursuits, and often habits are formed that ruin the life both for this world and for the world to come. This has been emphasized by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Adventist teachers and ministers and parents. You don't have to go to our schools to learn it, just stay home. And they go out to get distinction of scholarship, gain position and honor in the world, and they forget missionary service. And we think we're teaching them aright when we teach them that. But we've confused them terribly. And their pride rises up and their selfishness, it completely overwhelms any spirit of sacrifice. And they give up the life of giving to live a life of self-seeking. And then we try to justify that. And then we try to say, I wonder why my life is not more rewarding. I wonder why I don't feel like I'm achieving, why I'm not fulfilling my experience in my life. What's wrong? You cannot mingle the philosophies of the world and the principles of God and arrive at good answers. You cannot do that. They're competitive. They're opposite poles. Adventism today is trying to make the two compatible. They are not compatible. They're irreconcilable enemies. They're mortal enemies. Giving is destructive of selfishness. Selfishness is destructive of giving. They cannot live together side by side. They're at war with each other. They're as much at war with each other as Christ and Satan. Are they not? Two completely opposite, divergent philosophies. You cannot make them harmonious. There is no system of education that will ever accomplish that. This is Babylonish. It's confusing to everyone, the faculty and the students and the parents. All are confused. You just cannot have your cake and eat it too. It's impossible. Either we're sacrificial and giving, or we're selfish and receiving. It's one way or the other. And there's no way you can justify selfishness under the garb of giving. No way. You can try, but everybody else knows you're a phony. Everyone knows that. And too often we go in the Lord's service to receive. Even ministers, as low as our salaries, go in there for receiving. They say, at least I'll get sustentation. So what? You'll be dead all your life. Isn't that right? And everybody else knows you're dead, except you yourself. The Lord's work is not an excuse for selfishness. Not at all. If the spirit of sacrifice and unselfishness and giving and service is not there, everyone knows that. And somehow these days, this chapter just doesn't ring a bell to us anymore. Somehow we think we can serve self and serve humanity at the same time. And God says, if you want to be healthy, if you want to love life, if you want to be rewarded, if you want to be fulfilled in your inmost hearts, you must be a giver, forgetful of self, loving human beings, serving human beings, serving God. They'll be blessed, you'll be blessed. And that life will be a representative of the life of Christ, representation, a manifestation. And all men shall call you blessed, because you bring such good things to them. May God help us to clearly distinguish that if we're going to be healers, restorers of life, life givers, we must be givers. True education is a missionary training that fits us to go out and give and give and give, ministering to all the needs of mankind until Jesus comes and says, "Well done, good and faithful servant, a minister, a giver." Let us stand for prayer. Loving Father in heaven, we're so grateful the Lord understands us, that He knows all our human weaknesses, all our failures, all our misunderstandings, and yet He's forgiving, and He holds out to us a better way of life. May we spend much time looking unto Jesus until we see in Him a marvelous peace, a very fulfilling, rewarding, achieving life, so filled with good things. May we not be afraid to follow Him, but afraid to follow the world and its goals. Help us as parents to understand how easily we misdirect our children in their aspirations and their goals and their education. Help us to understand as educators and ministers and others how often, even by our example, we're misdirecting them. May the Lord grant that our lives be filled with dedication to Jesus, that we might be like Him in service, and giving and giving and giving, that others might live, that others might be made well, that they might be lifted up, that they might be restored, that they might be made new again in the image of Christ, until that happy day when the Lord will come and take us home, and there throughout the ages of eternity, we will serve one another in the marvelous Spirit of Christ. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.